Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, this is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and again, honored to be talking to the best audience in the world, maybe in outer space, on issues of human beings trying to live better lives, trying to improve the lives of others, offering human services of all kinds to make this very difficult path on Earth easier, happier, more productive, more just, more free. Today, I'm going to be talking with Peter Kinderman again. I've spoken to him fairly recently. The original purpose of having Peter on was as a part of interviewing each of the chapter authors of The Sedated Society by James Davies, which is a book that brings together some of the most advanced thinkers and practitioners. Nearly all these folks are involved in practice in some way or another. It's an important book. Peter Kinderman is an extremely important contributor in Great Britain. He's a professor of psychology. He's president of the British Psychological Association. He focuses his research on the psychological processes that are basic to human well-being, what we call mental health. And he likes to look at the whole shebang, the whole issue. The biological, the psychological, I don't know where I came up with whole shebang, but I don't even know where that word comes from. But all the issues, including the politics behind the causes of mental, emotional distress, human failure, self-defeat, defeat by others. And the politics behind the delivery services. We come from somewhat, if not very, different orientations, as I would with anybody working in the National Health Service in Great Britain. I'm in private practice. I love the private practice model. I don't exclude other models. And you'll see with great clarity where Peter Kinderman is coming from. And I really look forward to once again looking deeply into your ideas, Peter, about the delivery of services as well as the causes of human distress. So I'm going to hand the mic over to you in Great Britain. And please use this platform to express your overview of all these subjects.
Okay. Well, thanks, Peter. So, I think that you're absolutely right in terms of some of the points of contact that you and I have. So, I guess one of the things that I have done, like my colleagues who work in, I guess, what in Europe we would call social psychiatry, so psychiatrists who are looking at the ways in which mental health problems can be seen less as diseases of the brain to be put right with medicine and more as the consequences of the struggles that we as individuals have to make in life. So that social psychiatry background is very similar to the background that I come from. And like many of my colleagues, like many of those of us who were involved in writing Sedated Society, I guess I reject not only the disease model of psychiatry, but I reject the idea that the psychiatric drugs somehow put right those diseases. Where you and I, Peter, might slightly part company is that I take things in a slightly different direction in terms of what we should do about it. So I guess my journey has moved from being a clinical psychologist, and therefore I suppose the risk then is that you still do therapy with people, you still see the problems as lying somehow within their heads. And I moved much more into the idea of looking at human well-being. And that means that for me, because I reject a disease model of distress, and because I think of how we as human beings are responding to the social systems in which we live, the abuse and the hopelessness and the poverty and the racism that some people unfortunately grow up in, I look much more to social solutions to the problems than psychotherapeutic solutions. That then takes me towards thinking not only that we shouldn't diagnose people with illnesses and then medicate them, but maybe we should be looking to much more social interventions than traditional healthcare interventions. And that's taken me in the direction of not only thinking about socialized medicine, of which I am a big supporter, but also the idea that we should see psychiatry less as a sort of referral route out of the hospitals and into the clinics, but more that we as psychologists and public health doctors and psychiatrists should be working in the community with city councils, looking at the social and psychological well-being of citizens. So it's much more of a model based on social work, based on the role of city authorities, based on the idea of what we certainly in the UK are very proud of, which is our National Health Service and the idea of a socialized healthcare system. So that's the perspective that I come from. I think you and I start from very similar positions in terms of the medicalized, atomized approach to psychiatry. I think perhaps our solutions are a little bit different.
I think of it as having to do with who you're trying to deliver services to. Mm-hmm. And in the private practice model, coming to me with issues, they're not asking me to intervene in their broader lives, nor do they want it. So the people who come to see me, by and large, but not always so, are not poverty-ridden, and their major issues would not be racism. They might feel their major issues are sexism or other things that impinge directly on the family. And most of them come to see me because they're deeply troubled in their family lives. You know, they're not happily in love, or they're having terrible problems with their children, and they need to learn new and better ways to relate and make choices. On the other hand, I know that mental well-being is enhanced or impaired by economic conditions, by racism, by sexism, by a whole variety of different issues. And that would be social psychiatry. We actually, Peter, we had social psychiatry in this country a number of years ago, and it was something I was quite interested in. We had great studies of poverty, the relationships of poverty to human personal suffering, and it was just killed off by the partnership between psychiatry and the drug company. So we don't have social psychiatry anymore. Yeah. But let me stop there and give it back to you.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm very proud of being a clinical psychologist, and my expertise is in, I guess, how I would describe for a technical audience the job that I do on a day-to-day basis would be schema-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. So I mean, my stock in trade is, as for me as a professional, is sitting down one-to-one, helping people make sense of their difficulties, helping people make sense of the way in which they have learned to deal with the challenges in life, and possibly helping them find different ways to understand their situation, different ways to respond to their situation. So I'm not suggesting for one instant that we should restrict the availability of psychotherapy. And I think exactly the opposite, really, which is that I think that for many people, especially people who are victims of poverty and racism, that form of psychotherapy is absolutely helpful. But I would say two things. The first is that I think that as well as offering individuals therapeutic solutions, we also need to be tackling the underlying social structures that give rise to these problems. And there's a whole range of issues that we need to deal with there, from the abuse of children, which is a matter for the whole community and not just for families and individuals, bullying at school, racism, homophobia, sexism, the denial of workers' rights, abusive employment practices, short-term contracts, job insecurities, housing insecurities, the threat of violence on the streets, police brutality. There's a whole range of issues that we should not be blind to when we just deliver psychotherapeutic interventions for people. And the other thing, of course, is that when we do offer psychotherapy to people, we need to make sure that everybody in our community can afford it. So that means, for me, that means some sort of system whereby, whether through insurance or through state insurance or through the sort of socialized medical approaches that we have in Western Europe, what we need to make sure is that everybody who might benefit from those forms of psychotherapy can access them. And that means, for me, something involving organization and coordination at the level of the state. So I think that I'm a big fan of psychotherapy. I just need to make sure that we ensure that everybody can have access to psychotherapy. And that, as well as being a big fan of psychotherapy, I think we need to pay as much attention to addressing issues of job insecurity, poverty, wage inequity, social exclusion, racism, bullying, and so forth, as we do to picking up the pieces as psychotherapists when people are distressed.
This is so interesting. I haven't actually gone very deeply into this on the show, but I think you're a really good person to do it with. I certainly agree with you that a whole range of things make life better for people or make them make life more difficult and potentially miserable for people. My concern is that that the progressive view, which this eventually becomes, is not the only view at all, especially in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So that how do we distinguish between things we can all agree upon, things I've been deeply interested in? You know, I wrote a book on racism with my wife called The War Against Children of Color. I'm very interested in the abuse of women, and I wrote in Toxic Psychiatry, I've got one of the early chapters mm-hmm. on how psychiatry abuses women and uses actually the women abuse model for its treatment model. And I also have been very interested in child abuse. My latest book, Peter, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, has two chapters devoted entirely to the more subtle and horrendous forms of child abuse. But then we go beyond that to, well, how do you build better families? Or we go to, say, police. You didn't, when you brought up the police issue, you brought it up as police abuse. A lot of us in this country think that that's a minor problem compared to the lack of police presence in the inner cities of America to help people live safely, and that the whole issue of attacking police is reducing the safety of everyone in the inner cities, because it's not the most fundamental problem is not abuse. The most fundamental problem is the hamstringing of police, the lack of police, the lack of safety from gangs in particular.
That's
the problem.
Where...
We get into the political area. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think that. So if we take toxic psychiatry, I think that any fair-minded person, and you know, I'm a big fan of the book, I have to say, I'm a big fan of your work in it, but any fair-minded person reading toxic psychiatry would suggest that it's a very political book. It's not Democrat versus Republican or socialist versus capitalist, but it's a very political book because it speaks to because there's another point here, which is whether you're talking about mental health problems or whether you're talking about lost productivity in the workplace or whether you're talking about some sort of sum total of human distress or whether you're talking about the number of people diagnosed with mental illnesses, I think it's clear that mental health issues are a pretty big part of civic society, of the business of politics. However you deal with it, it's a large part of our healthcare infrastructure. It's important in terms of our productivity as workers. It's very important in terms of the sum total of life satisfaction of citizens. And so when you're writing a book like Toxic Psychiatry, when you're talking about whether or not the big frameworks of understanding that we have about why people become distressed, you know, the idea that distress represents symptoms of an illness that lies in the brain, and an illness that manifests itself with biochemical abnormalities or imbalances in the brain that can be put right with these drugs, which I know is the model that you attack and reject, and so do I. That's a political act in itself. So I think we're bound to be in politics, but we don't have to be in party politics. So, you know, I'm not an expert on current American political situations. I have my views, but my views are based mainly on the media, although at this point I have to point out that my sister is actually an American citizen. But I'm not really talking about party politics. So what I'm interested in is the principles. Now, I don't know. I have my views, and my guess is that you'll be able to guess what my voting allegiance is. But I don't know whether Obamacare, as Barack Obama envisaged it and wrote it into law, would be a near-perfect way of delivering equitable health care, including psychological health care, to the citizens of the USA. I don't know that. I don't know whether it would be better than the NHS in Great Britain, which has its flaws. I don't know whether either of those two systems would be as good as the Canadian system or the German system or the Norwegian system. And in part, that probably depends on how much we spend as a proportion of our GDP on it. Although I have to point out that America spends a lot on healthcare, and a lot of that goes to profits for companies. But anyway, I don't know which is the best system. And I don't know whether the reforms that are being proposed in the US at the moment to change Obamacare will make it better or make it worse. My point is that what we want our politicians to do is ensure two things. First of all, that those absolutely real root causes of mental health problems, the racism, the poverty, the lack of hope, the inequity, the unfairness of the way in which wealth is distributed in our nations, the lack of opportunity, the lack of promise for people, the bullying, the individual unpleasantness that is directed at children at school by their peers, the ways in which people are categorized and tested and segregated from a very young age, the messages, all of those things we would want to be addressed. And secondly, however we reform healthcare systems in terms of Obamacare or the National Health Service or the freeing up of private industry to provide healthcare. I'm not so interested in which of those options we choose. What I'm interested in is whichever of the options we choose, we need to ensure that people are given equitable access to healthcare. So it's just as easy for a learning disabled black woman with three kids without a job and living on food stamps to access psychotherapy as it is for the chief executive of Google. When that equity is established, then we'll have a fair system. I really don't care whether it's Barack Obama or Donald Trump that brings in that equity, but I know what the principles are that I want to lie behind it.
Well, I think this is very, very important. You know, equity is not a basic American principle. Our country was founded on the idea of individual freedom, where each person, according to his ability, develops his own life. It isn't from each according to his ability to each according to his need, which is the fundamental socialist Marxist principle. It's not that at all. It's a different approach. And
so
it starts with
really
the individual. Let me just talk for a minute, and I'll let you talk. It's about people developing their own selves to the maximum, and the unit is the unit of support is not the government in the basic American concept of the founding of America, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. The basic unit is the family. And charity played a much larger role, especially in the beginning. It certainly can't do everything now, private charity, rather than government. So we don't, those of us who believe in the traditional founding principles, which are very radical, radical principles in America, the most radical ever promoted, we think that the idea is how do you promote individual liberty to the greatest extent? And that's and the idea would be that happiness would have to do with being proud of your life, being proud of your country, which is, again, not an internationalist concept. So I think there's a different beginning.
I think there is. So one of the things that's interesting about this conversation, which is, again, a point of contact between us, which is that if you accept a biomedical disease model of psychiatry, these issues are unimportant. Big psychological questions of, you know, what does it
exactly?
What does it take for people to be happy? What is the purpose? What are the secrets of human contentment? Why do people become anxious? Why do people become hopeless? Those questions, in a sense, don't get answered in the biomedical model. They don't get posed, rather. They don't bring up the, because the answer is not, you know, what is a good life? What makes for a stable and happy life? How would you know on your deathbed that you have led the life that you wanted to lead? Those questions aren't important in traditional psychiatry. What's important in traditional psychiatry is diagnosing mental illnesses or not. When you start thinking about, as I think I do, and I think you do, actually, to be honest, when we start thinking about our mental health in terms of what does it take to lead an optimally satisfied life, content life? What circumstances do we need? What mental attitudes do we need? What relations do we need? You know, what are the components of a psychologically healthy life? It means you have to ask some very difficult questions. You can't, for instance, if you go down this route, simply say everybody is responsible for their own actions unless they're ill, because that question doesn't make sense in the way that I think about the non-existence of psychiatric illnesses. So when you say, you know, talking about this idea of you and I now in this conversation are talking about some important and even political, philosophical principles, absolutely, yes. And I think it's good that we have that conversation, because it's a corollary of trying to understand what it means to be happy, what it means to be content, what it means to lead a good life. Where I would agree with you, even though I would cast myself as a socialist, is about the idea of opportunity and freedom, and the idea of pursuing a concept of individual liberty for people as they try to create for themselves the most optimum lives that they have. So for me, when I listen to you, Peter, and you know what you were presenting was a very good, I think, but relatively conventional American and possibly I don't know, it's not right-wing, but it's American, I guess, capitalist model as opposed to a socialist model. Talking about freedom, talking about opportunity, talking about allowing each individual person in their family to make the best of their lives that they can with the opportunities they find themselves. I agree with that 100%. Absolutely agree with it. But that's what I see socialism as being. So for me, the idea that an individual is not able, not free, to pursue the life that they want, not able to take the opportunities that are out there in life, not able to create for him or herself and for their family the life that they want. It's that that I strive for. But I strive for it through equity, to make that opportunity open to everyone. So for me, if you're a poor, in the case of Britain, it would be slightly different from America, but if you are a working-class laborer from the north of England, you'll be systematically excluded from most of the opportunities that exist. And your life chances are dependent on the decisions of others, on the decisions of the shareholders or the owners of businesses to open or close manufacturing plants as they choose. And you might at any one time be made redundant, thrown out of work, and therefore the safety and security that you have in employment would be taken away from you. So for me, the trade unions, the protection of workers' rights, the provision of state benefits for people who are unemployed, these are mechanisms whereby we come together as communities to protect and defend those freedoms and liberties that allow people to pursue the opportunities that you're talking about. And I would go further, which is that when I look at some of those things that make people unhappy, it's things like unfettered freedom. So you talked about the safety on the streets. And, you know, America is a very unsafe place. It's a very dangerous place. And one of the reasons is that people have freedom. They have the freedom to own and carry guns. So for me, my freedom to be free from fear, my freedom to walk down the streets unhindered, my freedom to even to pursue the sort of lifestyle that I wish to pursue is being threatened by unfettered libertarianism. So for me, I absolutely 100% agree with the idea of opportunity and freedom and the idea that each individual person should have the autonomy and the capacity to pursue those ambitions that he or she has for himself or her family. But that's not, in my mind, achieved by allowing nature to take its course. It's achieved by putting in place structures that allow for fairness and equity. And my example would be the rules of fair play on the sports field. Rules are vitally important in order to allow the best athlete to win. So if you did not have rules, you could not ensure that everybody gets a fair chance. It would be an unfettered free-for-all. People would have knuckle dusters and clubs, and they'd start kicking the ball whenever they felt like it, and the whole thing would be both chaos and unfair. What you get with rules and with an umpire and with a structure that supports the systems of society is you get fairness, and in fairness, you allow people, even poor people, even people without the natural benefits of birth, to hope, to aspire to those opportunities that should be there for everybody. So my point is that in that psychological model of what makes us happy and what makes us sad, I 100% agree with you about the ideas of opportunity and freedom. And I think that it's important that as we discuss, you know, what makes for good mental health, what makes for happiness, what makes for positive psychological well-being, we should have these discussions. And I would genuinely agree with you about what the aims and aspirations are. I think all we differ,
Peter, let me interrupt
how we go about achieving it.
I do want you to have more time than me, and I'm doing that very carefully.
I want to
be able to get in a little response
sure,
to it.
Sorry.
And let me I want to respond on three different levels, and I'm going to be more like with axioms, because I actually do want people to hear your viewpoint as much as possible. First, all of the good things you describe, when a government does them, as far as I understand history, the more the government does it, the more there's a catastrophe. And I think that without America and its more libertarian, certainly not libertarian, and I'm not a complete libertarian by any means anymore anyway. I've gone from socialism to libertarianism to really a more fundamental American founding principles, which I write about in a little book called Wow, I'm an American.
I've seen it, yes.
The notion that I come from is that what you're describing, the government becoming, is worse than all the things you're fixing, and that it generally will go in that direction, and that there aren't any ideal utopian communities like that that don't become extremely oppressive to their citizens. So that would be just a brief response. A second point I would make.
Okay.
Now let me have just a little bit of time to make a response, okay? And then I'm going to actually giving you much more airtime than I'm going to be taking.
Okay.
The second point I would make is that the sports team model is the opposite of your model. The sports team model is exactly the model, the nearest thing there is to the model of the founding of this country, which is that there are rules to prevent aggression. There are rules about how to conduct yourself in society. But within those rules, it is actual ability and determination and these other qualities of competition that lead to victory. Now, on the one hand, for example, sports in this country have been a tremendous opportunity for African Americans, because it's one of the places increasingly where they have equal opportunity, and they didn't originally. So that's the racism issue. So as we've let African Americans enter every field, that is similar in its model to sports, which is the competitive model. The more African Americans and women enter into these competitive fields in America, we have dramatic changes, so that minorities dominate in many areas in America, and women, who are not a minority, are now more than half of our medical schools and so on. So the sports model is the model that I would embrace, and the progressives in our country hate the sports model, and they want a model where everybody gets a trophy. So, and then the final thing I want to just raise, the way this came down to me, the nuts and bolts of my own experience was how did I do therapy? And I found that the single most important principles that helped my clients grow and that helped my life grow were, first, personal responsibility, first and foremost, which is the profound American concept. Liberty, so we can take personal responsibility. And then was freedom, individual freedom, while not using force, while respecting others, the basic libertarian model. And what I found was that people who come to therapy sometimes, who have a more socialist model, really don't give themselves the opportunity to even take responsibility to change and develop their lives. So in some cases, this is not common, but in some cases, carrying the socialist model out to its more extreme form interferes with therapy, while the libertarian model of take responsibility for your life, build your life, respect the freedom of others, and I put on to it, love one another, you know, find love in your life. So it's really basic differences. And finally, I think we really agree that mental health concepts in general crush this discussion. You don't get to have this discussion if you believe in the biological diagnostic model. So we can have this discussion because neither of us goes to that insanely simplistic and horribly oppressive model. So now I want to give the mic back to you.
Well, I absolutely agree with that last point. And I think that one of the things that we collectively have to do is to think about these very important implications of what's emerging as a new, much more psychosocial model of mental health, because they do have profound implications. I think that just this little conversation is important. And I think this issue of personal responsibility is a good one. So I'm absolutely with you on the importance of personal responsibility in life generally, but also in the model of mental health that I practice. One of the things that I've said, not necessarily in writing, but certainly in seminars that I've given at the university, is about how one of the possible reasons why the biomedical model of mental health is attractive, in fact, I have written about this, I have to say, is that it allows people to duck responsibility. You almost are able to say, it was not me, it was my brain, which is, in Descartesian terms, a ludicrous thing to say. Our brain is the organ with which we think. It doesn't make sense to separate out me from my brain. And yet the biomedical model asks questions. So lawyers, when they ask me for opinions on court cases, will ask questions like, was he responsible for his actions, or was he suffering from a mental illness at the time? And that's a very strange question, because the answer can be both yes and both no, and it doesn't matter, and neither all at the same time. So when you start to reject the idea that there is this thing called an illness, which is somehow separate from myself, and my brain is somehow separate from my mind and somehow separate from me, and my brain can be ill, when you reject that sort of muddled thinking, one of the consequences is you do have to confront the idea of personal responsibility. My own view is that personal responsibility is something somewhat different from blame. So I think that I am I recognize the importance of personal responsibility, but that's not the same as blaming individuals for their difficulties. But I also would say that with personal responsibility, you also have to understand the reasons why people act and behave in the way that they do. And I think it's not just the case that a person makes a decision to act in a particular way, and it's in some sense natural free will that causes them to act in that way. I think there are reasons why people make the choices that they make. And so, for instance, I think that if you have, if you believe yourself to have very little invested in society, then you can see why there would be relatively little barrier to you committing crimes, for instance. So the person is still responsible for the actions they take, but I think we have to simply acknowledge the fact that there are reasons why they take responsibility. So I'm with you on personal responsibility, and I'm absolutely with you that a focus on personal responsibility, again, is a corollary of a rejection of a simplistic biomedical model of mental health. And I think it does raise some very interesting and important and sometimes difficult questions. I have a slightly different point about your or response to your issue about government interfering, because I recognize the point that is made that when governments interfere in people's personal lives, it can be very difficult. I think that however, that those of my friends and those of my colleagues on the political right have a different attitude towards this than me. And the example I would give is certainly in Western Europe, and particularly in countries like Norway, there are three things that are absolutely important. The first is, yes, you're right, there is a much, much bigger role for the state. Absolutely. Norway has a much, much more involved state system in people's lives, much more involvement, much more investment, much more control in the part of the state. But it's also in Western Europe where we have an almost fetishistic respect for human rights. The Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, British lawyers drew up the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, and the European Union is founded on the Fundamental Declaration of Human Rights, one of which is people's absolute right to personal autonomy. So the point about the state overriding people, at least in Eastern Europe, I understand, in the Soviet Union, I understand. What we see in Western Europe is not that at all. We see the state as being an organ that defends personal autonomy. It's not an organ that overrides personal autonomy. And the founding principle of Western democracies is the fact that the state is there to protect your right to autonomy. And then finally, when it comes down to, so what's the net consequence? When you look at one of the jobs that I have as an academic is I'm involved in looking at national well-being, looking at personal subjective well-being for the Office for National Statistics. And when you look at those countries in which people respond with highest levels of personal life satisfaction, most of the countries that come up top for individual personal life satisfaction are the Nordic countries with their highly developed state systems. So Norway and Sweden and Denmark routinely are countries where individuals say that they are the happiest individuals. And I don't think it's an accident that those are the countries where the state exists primarily to defend the autonomy and the personal liberty of the individuals through bills of individual freedoms and rights.
Gosh, I've heard a lot of different things about the Nordic countries. I've been there a few times, but not enough to have enough personal experience, but that there is, in fact, quite a bit of depression and apathy in those countries and a fair amount of suicide. So I'm hearing kind of different things.
Well,
but they're also very small countries. They're very, very...
I get to talk about that.
I'm giving you more time than me.
So,
I think they're very small countries, too, whereas we're a huge country with huge... economic disparities, huge immigrant populations, and so on, where things are much more complex here. I get the much more feeling when I go to Europe of groupthink than I do in the U.S. There's a much wider variety of political opinion here. In fact, half of our political opinion here is absolutely ridiculed. In Europe, there's a groupthink about Israel. It's very negative. I don't get a sense of the government protecting individuality the way you think it does. I think we probably have more individuality here in our country, I would think, in a lot of ways. I mean, it's why a lot of people want to live here. Why, when we open up our borders, lots of people want to come here. They also want to go where you are. But let me address it in a different way, which is that these are the critical issues in life. And biggest concerns that in America that many of us have that's being fought out now in Congress is that, in fact, the more you go in the direction of that big government, the less vitality you will have. America is probably the most creative country in the world, probably produces more new ideas, more new machines, more new medical advances than any place in the world, including much bigger countries like China. There's a lot of vitality here, a lot of marvelous stuff here, a huge spectrum of ideas and behaviors, except in our universities, which are very much like Europe, and in which a person who holds conservative views can't speak, literally. Poor me. I can't speak in the universities often because of my criticism of psychiatry in the pharmaceutical industry. And then on top of it, I can't speak because I have conservative views. But setting aside our media, which is like Europe, and our universities, which are like Europe, which are very oppressive to individual freedom, I think we've got a lot of things going here. And so while it might be fine for you to pursue the direction you want to go in, for many of us to go in that direction with the big government is stifling, although it has great advantages. Having a Hitler or a Mussolini has great advantages. And the first thing that people often do is, they kick out the Churchill and they bring in somebody else. But the concern we have, I don't think in America is averaging out happiness or anything like that. It's much more about individual freedom and opportunity. It's a different idea for many of us, but we feel through the universities and the media, we see it going more in your direction. Again, I give the mic back to you.
Well, I mean, again, it's interesting raising the spectrum of dictators. I would just slip in that we've had dictators like Mao and Stalin from the left, and we've had dictators like Mussolini and Hitler from the right. So I'm not
no,
sure
they're
that
from
anyone,
the left. That is the biggest. That's the only one that gets my. He was the National Socialists. He was for redistributing
was
wealth.
His,
he was going to have the Volkswagen. No.
Now
there were some insane American conservatives who favored him, but he was a big government fascist type person. That's not what we're talking about.
Well,
that is not.
And
I don't know any conservatives who identify with Hitler, but I know many who identify with Mao and Xi and Cuba. So I want to set that one as. We do disagree violently.
Okay.
Nah, not violently. We do disagree strongly on that.
Okay. Fair enough. I mean, I think that the question. people should, I think, disagree passionately about politics because these are principled issues to do with how nations are run and how they should be run. But there are also issues to do with practicalities. So, what are the best ways to establish the greatest happiness for the greatest number? And I think
that is not the goal of America. Hang on. No, we have to stop there. That is not the goal. When somebody comes to me for therapy, I do not think I want you, my client, to establish the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest number of people. I don't believe that's the goal of a country. That's the goal of a family, of a personal life, of a love life, of individual creativity.
Okay.
Very different view, but you're taking it for granted as a mental health view. I would hope contribute would be to separate these political views from a lot of what we deliver in services, because no, the greatest good for the greatest number is not necessarily what government is about. And every time that has happened in any extent, it has not been very good for most people.
Well, I mean, I have to say, I mean, this might be an area where we might disagree, because I think that both in terms of my politics, I mean, I don't find anything that you've said in any way distasteful. I think it's a question of, practicalities and utility and, what's a sensible way to organize the world. I think that one area where I would disagree, but be clear is, for me personally, I think that is the way in which I understand my goals as a political agent, as a human being interested in the politics of my world. Yes, it is about the greatest good for the greatest number. And no, it's not about an atomized and individual approach. But that also applies to my role as a mental health professional. So one of the things that's happening in the UK at the moment is that we are thinking very deeply about the best practical steps to deliver psychological therapies to people. So we have something in the UK called the IAPT program, although it's changing its nature as political governments change. But this is a long-standing plan by our Ministry of Health and our National Health Service to deliver CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, to all of those people who might benefit from it. And in that, first of all, I think the principle that our aim should be to provide the greatest levels of happiness to the greatest number, I think is widely accepted by a large number of people. Certainly I see it that way. But also when it comes down to decisions about funding, yes, I think that we are collectively making decisions about the way in which we would provide healthcare so that the largest number of people could benefit maximally from the services that we have to offer, rather than the alternative, which would be to create the most specialist service that we can and then hope that people will be able to access it later. So we are designing our services in terms of the provision of psychotherapy from the principle that we need to get those evidence-based interventions which the National Institute for Clinical Excellence has deemed to be an effective therapy for people who are distressed. The aim then is to try to get the maximum number of people access to those therapies in the best way possible. So that principle of the maximum happiness for the maximum number, that's underpinning the way in which we design mental health services as well. And for me personally, I need to make decisions on that basis too. So would I offer a clinic for individual referrals, or would I offer a group-based approach? What should I target my therapy at referrals from the local psychiatric hospital or from the local family doctor? And in part, the decisions are based on what would give the maximum number of people the maximum benefit. So, yeah, I think that's an important principle, to be honest.
It is. It's a very important difference. Let me take a minute and tell you a little bit about what I'm doing with a partner that I'm working very, very closely with. We're trying to partner in a number of ways, named Pam Popper. She's a nutritionist. And Pam is the leader here. And one of the things that we're working on is how to set up for-profit clinics that would exist right inside corporations on their first floor, mm-hmm. in which there were several tiers of providing services, but the two primary services to begin with would be completely non-medical psychotherapy. We're developing training programs so that people don't have to be PhDs and go to medical school or anything else like that to deliver therapy services. I think they can be delivered very well by people who have a couple of years of experience and supervision as therapists without a lot of prior education. So we're trying to develop a model for first delivering mental health services relatively inexpensively by finding good people rather than highly trained people and teaching them to do therapy. The second thing is nutrition, because a lot of folks now, and I'm coming late to this, believe that 90% of the medical issues in America certainly are bad nutrition. Not lack of availability, because good food is actually relatively inexpensive. I mean, starting with things like rice and potatoes and yams and a variety of other things. But that a vegetable-based diet is a key. And then these clinics will have medical doctors who've been trained partly by me and very much by Pam in what interventions the medical approaches work, not in mental health at all. And one of the things that Pam is intent upon is not only delivering this service, but requiring that the clinic that's being paid for by the corporation allow Pam to provide reduced cost services to the community. So here is a more American approach, in a sense, an approach that that's bringing together principles that you and I probably deeply share. I imagine you believe in most people now who've been way ahead of me on these nutritional issues. So that's the direction I'm going in. The other thing that interests me is, yes, you and I are very similar. We do work very hard, in a sense, for the greater happiness. Certainly, you and I don't put our own happiness ahead of everyone else's. We've taken great risks in our lives to make contributions. But I notice as a therapist that, and maybe you could just comment on this as one of our last thoughts. As a therapist, none of my clients want to follow in my footsteps. Hardly any. The only ones are ones who already come injured by psychiatry and wanting to do reform work. When I work with most people, it turns out what they want is to build very happy, productive, creative lives for themselves and their loved ones and for their community, but not through some government imposed thing, but by working at Rotary Club or by working at their church. And this greater good for the greater number and all, I mean, I think it's a very dangerous concept. And of course, many people do and many people don't. But those are just some parting thoughts. I think we're going to be finishing in a few minutes, and I'm going to just give the mic back to you and to say this has been extremely interesting. Folks, I haven't even reminded you. We're talking to Peter Kinderman, who is a marvelous psychologist, currently president of the British Psychological Society. And what a interesting conversation, Peter. Your thoughts?
It's a fantastic conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely. And I think that, yes, we do agree on an awful lot of things. I think it's very important that as we move away from a biomedical model of human distress, I think we should have these discussions about the important things. I just want to come back to you on one point, which is when you're talking about people, especially in America, with a tradition of working with the community, working with church groups, working with Rotary clubs and so forth. Absolutely, yes. I would see that as entirely consistent with the idea of a community-based, I would see it almost as, you're going to hate me for this, and it's going to be like, you know, shock, horror headlines. But I think that those people who volunteer to work with their church community group or Rotary Club, they are entirely consistent with what I would regard as fair-minded, just, honorable,
wonderful. Well, and they really want to do good. I mean, many of them are Christians. I'm Jewish, yeah, although very much influenced by Christian principles. Many of them are very Christian people who really want to love one another. That's a problem we're having in America right now, because there's a huge shutdown. By the way, I think the reaching out issue will be more your reaching out to folks like me, because folks like me, when we speak about politics, we don't get a voice generally in your community, and we don't at all in America, in the areas that are dominated. I'm certainly happy to talk about these issues, but I think that there's a great tendency in Europe to reject me because of these issues, and in the United States, by the way. I've come under attack from people who would sacrifice what I contribute to the psychiatric reform movement because they view me as some abominable person in terms of my believing in the founding principles of the country, essentially. It's really quite tough, actually, in that regard. Yeah. Listen, this is very, very good. I'd like to we'll come back and talk again. And I just think all of this is so incredibly important, and we do have such a broad base of communality. It's really about the functions of government and whether we start with the individual or the society. And philosophical difference. Both? Can't hear you. I have completely lost Peter. I'm getting a note from my PRN network. I have 1 minute remaining, and I can't hear Peter Kinderman.
I'm still here.
You keep getting lost. Try again.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I'm still here.
Good, good, you're back. Say a word. We have 30 seconds, Peter. Say goodbye to the audience.
I think that when you talk about a focus on the individual and a focus on society, my single word would be, let's do both.
Sounds good to me. Thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Certainly one of the most interesting hours, I think, that I've had. And I just hope folks will maybe pass this one around. People need to hear that politics can be discussed in a caring, friendly manner, looking at both differences and similarities. This is a rarity in the United States, and I suspect in Europe. Thanks for listening. Keep in mind our very, very profound shared ideas for almost everybody Absolutely. Listening to this show. And take a look at my website, 123 Antidepressants. You can just do it from anywhere in the world. 123 Antipsychotics, 123 ECT, and you'll get huge scientific critiques for you to use. Bye now, folks.